Good evening, ladies and gentlemen of the radio audience. This is Graham McNamee speaking from Dearborn, Michigan, where Henry Ford and Edsel Ford are entertaining one of the most notable gatherings assembled in the annals of American history to honor Thomas Alva Edison on the occasion of the 50th anniversary of his invention of the first practical incandescent lamp. Tonight is the climax of light's golden jubilee, and what a climax. As you know, the entire world is celebrating this epochal event tonight. Nearly every great city will be aflame, and almost every village and hamlet is having its own celebration to honor the man whose genius made possible this great age of light in which we live. And I hope that you and your families are entering into the spirit of this great moment in history the way we are here in Dearborn. If you are, you are grouped about your radio under the flickering lights of 1879. If you can't light a kerosene lamp, and you probably can't, because they haven't been very popular since Mother O'Leary's cow kicked over the lantern and started the Chicago fire, light a candle or sit in the firelight so that when Mr. Edison reenacts that historic moment of 50 years ago, when the first electric light was born and the great replica of the Liberty Bell here in Dearborn announces to the world that the climax of light's golden jubilee has arrived, you can turn on your electric lights and add your personal tribute to that great outpouring of gratitude and personal affection which has made light's golden jubilee the greatest tribute ever paid to any living man. Here is a real chance to make this age of light live for every boy and girl in the land. I've attended many celebrations, but I can't recall ever attempting to describe one staged in a more perfect setting. The dinner that is now going on is taking place in one of the buildings of the Edison Institute of Technology. This building is an exact reproduction of Independence Hall in Philadelphia. I've just been thinking that the world couldn't celebrate its emancipation from darkness more fittingly than in this building, which is associated in the minds of all of us with freedom and progress. And now, let me see if I can't just sketch a bit of this picture for you. To the right and left of the main rotunda, where a statue of Thomas Edison will soon stand, two long wings stretch away, filled with some 500 of the most distinguished people in America. The high, wide halls are aglow with the light of thousands of candles, their golden brilliance dancing like sunlight on falling water as the facets of the great crystal chandeliers sway and twist. An interesting sidelight on this lighting is the fact that all of the candles used here tonight were hand-dipped today in the village. Against this background, imagine the checkered effect of black and white evening dress, the brilliant splashes of color provided by the uniforms of military attachés and the great stylists of Paris and Fifth Avenue. I had some idea before I started this broadcast of trying to tell you who is here tonight, but really, I don't know where to start. It seems as if everybody I ever heard of is here. A good deal of an animated who's who. The tables are arranged in the shape of a great T, and the head of this glittering letter is Mr. Edison's seat. I saw him a moment ago, and cupped over his ear in characteristic fashion to catch some word from the President of the United States. And there, close to him, have been sitting the hosts of the evening, Mr. Henry Ford and Mr. Edsel Ford. Mr. Owen D. Young is there, too. He is the toastmaster. And let's see whom else I can pick out of this amazing audience of ambassadors, industrialists, railroad presidents, statesmen, distinguished educators, and the great in all walks of life. Yes, here's one that will interest you, Madame Curie. You know whom she is, of course, the woman co-discoverer of radium. You wouldn't think to look at this quiet little Polish woman that she upset the beliefs of the whole scientific world on the structure of matter. And beyond here, I see one of the electrical leaders of Japan, H. Iharo. And let me see. Yes, here is Orville Wright, who with his brother Wilbur invented the airplane. There is Will Rogers, John D. Rockefeller Jr., Mr. M. S. Sloan, and A. W. Robertson. You know, I could go on indefinitely telling you who is here, but there isn't time. You'll just have to imagine all the people that you read about in your daily newspapers suddenly come to life in one place for one purpose. And while I'm on the subject, there is one group that I want to mention specifically, and that is the Edison Pioneers. These are the men who were associated with Mr. Edison during the days, the early days of his career. I want to tell you, just there's a bit of a lump in the throat as we look at these early pioneers of electricity. You can see that this is a night of nights for them. Their sturdy old faces are lighted up, and you feel as if any moment they might be on their feet cheering their beloved chief. Now the old orchestra will play again the good old tunes of 1879 on the instruments of 1879. You know what a dulcimer is? You know, I never really saw one until this afternoon. It's a bit of a cross between a piano and a xylophone, and it is played with hammers. Let's just for a moment tune in on some of these old airs as played by Mr. Ford's old-time orchestra. It is made up of three violins, this dulcimer, a bass viol, a cello, and a cymbalum. Cymbalum, you know, the Hungarian piano. And now the old-time orchestra plays for you.
This is Phillips Collins speaking. I'm very glad to take up the description where Graham left off, and especially to tell you something about the institution which Mr. Ford has founded here at Dearborn. You can say what you please, but life was a pretty nice proposition in those good old days. As you've perhaps read in the papers, President Hoover is here to dedicate the Edison Institute of Technology, which Mr. Ford has erected and endowed to perpetuate the life and achievements of his friend and hero, Thomas Alva Edison. part of this institute is a vast museum, which Mr. Ford has created to depict our industrial progress. The Edison Institute of Technology, with its great museum, Edison's Menlo Park, as it existed in 1879, and many other buildings of historic interest are grouped together in the charming American village, which Mr. Ford has christened Greenfield. And honestly, I have found out more about our country's past, what we rolled in, what we ate, how we lived, and how we amused ourselves in 2 hours here today than I think I could have get out of a dozen books in a dozen years. You can't fool me now about American history. I know how we dipped candles and what we took for whooping cough in the good old days when our grandfathers went courting in snappy runabouts and knobby beaver hats. As a part of this village, as I think I told you, Mr. Ford has recreated Menlo Park just as it was on that memorable day, October 21st, 1879, when the new light was born. Here, surrounded by modern technical education, the buildings in which the Age of Light came into being stand as they stood on that day a half century ago. Not reproductions, not exact replicas, but the actual buildings themselves. Not only the old wooden laboratory building and Mrs. Jordan's boarding house, where Edison's little band of pioneers ate, slept, dreamed, and argued, but the old lathes and the old workbench, the old lamps, and more from all over the country where they have strayed in 50 years. Mr. Ford has brought the old dynamos, the old wood-burning boilers, and the old glass house. Just to give you some idea of how far this shrine is original, I want to tell you that the very dirt upon which all these buildings stand is the earth of Menlo Park, New Jersey, brought to Greenfield by the carload, 7 carloads to be exact. This great event began this morning with the arrival of Mr. Edison and his party at Greenfield at 10 o'clock on a wood-burning train of the vintage of 1862. This train, which is part of Mr. Ford's institute, was met at the village station by most of the guests. This interesting old station was purchased by Mr. Ford and made a part of his collection because it was at this station that young Tom Edison, the train newsboy, was thrown off the train and out of a job because some of the chemicals with which he was experimenting in the baggage car took... Leaning forward. Ladies and gentlemen, I could talk for hours about this historic village. I would like to tell you about the old streets, lighted with the old-fashioned kerosene lamps, and the showboat that lays at anchor in the slip beyond the village green. But this dinner, which began at 6:15, is almost over. A few moments ago, Mr. Edison and President Hoover and their party left for the old laboratory to reenact that most important moment in history when the first practical incandescent lamp was given to the world, or as it was called in 1879, the newfangled contraption, a light which burns without gas or flame and is cheaper than oil. In a moment, Graham McNamee, who has dashed over to the laboratory with President Hoover and Mr. Edison, will tell you what is going on there. And here we are in the laboratory, ladies and gentlemen. From the upper windows, I can see Mr. Edison approaching in an old-fashioned horse-drawn carriage. He has just passed the old sawmill and turned from Main Street into Washington Street. These streets now have exactly the same appearance as they had in the old Menlo Park days. Before they get here, let me give you the setting for this unique drama of a half century ago. Here is the old laboratory where the first incandescent lamp was born. Below me on the first floor is the old office, the dark room, and a little room filled with retorts, scales, and old bottles. Just a word about the stairs. We just raced up, ladies and gentlemen. This afternoon I noticed a little cubby hole leading under them, and I was told that this dark little recess was one of Mr. Edison's favorite spots when he found it necessary to take a quiet nap from sheer exhaustion. You could always tell when he was taking a nap because his feet stuck out through the doorway. And now, let me give you some idea of the second floor, where the first practical incandescent lamp was born in 79, just 5 decades ago. It is a duplicate of the room below. It is lighted with gas, and the yellow fishtail flames are playing on the old walls and on the long rows of bottles and chemical containers just as they did 50 years ago. I spent a lot of time this afternoon reading the labels on these bottles
and wondering what they had to do with electricity and lighting. I saw old bottles with their old labels almost rubbed off, reading peanut oil, coconut hair, turkey red oil, cedar shavings, red rock salt, dogwood bark, Mayflower punk, black currant leaves, Jamaica ginger, and here's a funny one, hip fruit, and hundreds of others. I'm told that many of these bottles contain materials gathered by Mr. Edison in his search for a suitable filament material. This filament, as you perhaps know, was finally made of carbonized sewing thread. But before Mr. Edison finally hit on this material, including the red hairs from the beard of a man, you know, I was just thinking of what it would mean today if Mr. Edison had been successful with that hair. What a premium there would be on red beards to get enough hairs to make the filaments for the 300 or 400 million lamps that are now manufactured every year. But the center of the stage tonight is occupied by the vacuum pump. This is in the middle of the room, slightly to the left as you come upstairs. Because it is going to play such an important part in the climax of Light's Golden Jubilee, let me tell you just a bit about it. This pump was used by Mr. Edison to remove the air from his electric bulb. Mounted on an oak board about 6 feet high and 1 foot wide, it is made of glass and looks to me a good deal like a trombone, perhaps, without a horn. It's been sucking the air out of the old bulb now for about 8 hours, and it makes a rattle like a steam radiator. Mr. Edison's chair is here before the pump, and there's another chair for Mr. Francis Yale, who as a boy of 20 was one of Mr. Edison's assistants on that memorable night, and who will assist him here in a few moments. And oh yes, Mr. Yale is here now, waiting. He had just told me that the lamp is about ready to test. You'll pardon me if I seem to be having a little trouble with the voice, but the air is filled with sulfuric acid fumes from the long table of wet batteries just to the rear of this pump, and it makes talking a bit difficult. Mr. Edison arrives. He will try the vacuum in the bulb by applying the electrical current from the wet batteries, and then, before finally completing the lamp, he will go over to the old dynamo room and turn on the power. But here comes Mr. Edison. Here he is, ladies and gentlemen. He's in the lead, followed by President Hoover and the rest of the party. He's coming directly to the table behind the old vacuum pump. There's a notebook on the table. It was in a book such as this, I am told, that the records of the various lamp tests were kept. He's now turning the pages. Can you imagine how this grand old man must feel as he's carried back half a century to the moment of his great triumph? Oh, if I were a painter, I should like to portray this group about the pump. Why, the whole scene looks just like some picture from Harper's Magazine or Leslie's Weekly of nearly 50 years ago. And now, Mr. Yale is looking at the pump. He's saying something. Just a moment. Oh, yes. He has just told Mr. Edison that he believes the lamp has a good vacuum. Mr. Edison is nodding his head. Now he's picking up two small wires which lead from the main group of wet batteries, and he's touching them to the wire. This, I understand, is to assist in forcing the air from the bulb, as I think I told you. Apparently, Mr. Edison is not quite satisfied from this that the lamp is ready. He is now sitting in the chair before the pump. Mr. Yale is there opposite him. Down at the end of the room is a reproduction of the organ Mr. Edison used when he was experimenting with his phonograph. The boy has just started to pump it. You may close your eyes, ladies and gentlemen, and imagine that you are one of this anxious little group that half a century ago, waiting, hoping. Mr. Edison He's slouched back into a comfortable position, and as he sits calmly waiting for the old pump to complete its work, we will listen to his favorite air, Susanna, and then Take Me Home Again, Kathleen. Now Mr. Edison is again on his feet, ready to test the lamp. Now he holds the wires to the bulb. This test, evidently satisfactory. For he's telling Mr. Yale to seal up the bulb. Now Mr. Edison and his party are leaving momentarily to go downstairs and across the yard to the old dynamo room. While they're on their way, we'll turn the microphone over to Mr. Phillips Carlin, who is already there and who will describe to you the events that take place in the dynamo room.
In the old dynamo room, ladies and gentlemen, you know, I never before realized the difficulties which confronted Mr. Edison even after he made his first lamp. For after all, it was one thing to make a single lamp that could be lighted from a group of wet batteries in a laboratory, but it was something entirely different to provide a means to make the new lamp a practical thing for you and me in our homes. First, he had to generate sufficient electricity to make the lamp of practical use. Then he was faced with the necessity of transporting the electricity, once generated, to the consumer, and finally, he had to figure out a method to measure the current used. You get a real picture of what this invention really meant, ladies and gentlemen, when you see this little 100-foot building, and then visualize the great light and power plants of this country, which serve over 19 million homes throughout the land. But here's Mr. Edison and the rest of his party, just coming in the rear door. Before him is an old wood-burning boiler. And Mr. Edison is stepping before it for a minute, stopping, his hands deep in his pockets, a quizzical smile on his face. This boiler furnishes the steam for the old brown engine, which furnishes the power for the old bipolar electric generators designed by Mr. Edison to furnish the current for his electric lamp. As I said, this building is about 100 feet long and is slightly L-shaped at the end. Perfect maze of belts running the long way of the room and belts disappearing into the basement to operate the bipolar electric dynamos. I don't know whether you know what a bipolar electric dynamo is. I don't exactly. But in general, it looks to me like a pair of elongated spools of thread, about 4 feet high, 10 inches in diameter, mounted on a wooden base. There are 9 of these generators mounted on a platform in the rear of the old boiler. I'm told that they would light about 100 lamps. Just contrast this with the base generators of today, which have a capacity of 4,050-watt lamps each. But now, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Edison has gone to the steam engine is about to pen the steam throttle which releases the power. The throttle is down. Let me hold the microphone. You probably have been hearing it. Ladies and gentlemen, so you can get the whir of this old steam engine. This power plant is again operating as it did 50 years ago. Just imagine the memories, this stirring of familiar things must evoke in Mr. Edison's breast as he stands back, as he's now doing, and looks down the long room and sees again in his mind's eye the happy days of 79 and the busy days. Now Mr. Edison and his party are leaving, and I shall turn you back to Graham McNamee for a continuation of the laboratory program.
And again, ladies and gentlemen, I was just standing at one of the front windows looking out over the balcony, and I'd like to give you just a bit of an idea of this great audience that is waiting across the way for Mr. Edison and the President. A radio amplifying system has been installed so that everyone will be able to hear not only the speakers, but a description of the events which are about to occur within the old laboratory. You know, when I first looked out this window, I wondered what was wrong with this great throng. And just now, I realized what it was. I missed the light. There are no lights on the wide boulevards which stretch its way before this building. The only visible illumination was the flickering yellow flames from the kerosene lamp, which here and there dot the streets of Greenfield. All you have to do is imagine this shadowy, waiting mass to get an accurate picture of what night meetings must have looked like half a century ago. But here is Mr. Edison again. While he was at the powerhouse, Mr. Yale sealed up the old lamp, and it is now ready, as it was ready half a century ago, for the critical test. Will it light? Will it burn? Or will it flicker and die as so many previous lamps had died? Oh, you can hear a pin drop in this long room. Now the group is once more about the old vacuum pump. Mr. Edison has the two wires in his hand. Now he's reaching up to the old lamp. Now he is making the connection. Light, golden jubilee has come to a triumphant climax. Oh, Mr. Edison is now smiling, shaking hands with the President of the United States, Ford, and others. And now let us go for a minute to the belfry of Independence Hall and listen to the replica of the Liberty Bell as it tells the world that Edison's light has been born anew. Now the lights are springing up on all sides, the modern lights of 1929. Outside we hear the crowd cheering, but I can't give you a picture of what is going on there from here. Let me turn the microphone over to Phillips Carlin, who was on the laboratory balcony, just to give you some idea of this great moment.
The wonderful age of light has just come into magic being, as Graham's told you. Thousands of light are springing up on all sides. Great searchlights are cutting through the air, filling the night with wheeling, flashing paths of color. The old-fashioned lamps in the street corners have been replaced by modern Mazda lamps. And out of the night, I think I hear a plane that just appeared overhead with the word Edison and the figures 79 and 29 illuminated on the other underwing. Now this great crowd has gotten the spirit of the bell, and they're making terrific din with their automobile horns. Perhaps you can hear them even from here. And now the motorists are paying the tribute to the man who made night driving safe. They're turning on their headlights and then turning them off in a way that makes you think of some great telephonic switchboard. Somewhere over in the neighborhood of Detroit, there comes the sound of screeching sirens and the blowing of whistles. Suddenly illuminated by the pealing of this great bell. I can see the beacon of eternal light which has been erected at Menlo Park, New Jersey, flashing on. I can imagine New York, Philadelphia, Chicago, Atlantic City, St. Louis, San Francisco, and all the cities of the country, big and small, as they come out of darkness into light. I can imagine all of you about your radios now suddenly turning on your electric lights and joining in this great celebration
in honor of the great hero of peace and progress. Menlo Park is completely floodlighted. This old port stands out in what is almost daylight. Wherever we turn, we're met by a blaze and color of light that exceeds anything I've ever seen. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the old-time Ford Orchestra will play another favorite of 50 years ago.
Thank you. ladies and gentlemen, this is William S. Lynch speaking from Independence Hall. It is my honor to present our celebrated toastmaster, Mr. Owen D. Young.
Hearts and minds of all who hear my voice. My first word must be not one of appreciation of your great inventions or of the service which they have rendered, but rather one of congratulation on that vitality of spirit which makes you do what you do. To be sure, you come to Greenfield Village today, adventuresome still, as if life lay all ahead of you and none behind. To be sure, the passengers on your railway train took a little more notice of you than they did 70 years ago when you tried to sell them papers. The greeting at Smith's Creek Depot was a little warmer than on that memorable day in 1861 when the railroad people dispensed with your services because you set fire to their cars. With this same vitality of which I speak, aided by a little phosphorus. That was a great day for the electrical industry. One might say that it was largely born at Smith Street Depot. The same unconquerable will and unquenchable fire which took you out of that depot, which set you on your career, brings you back to it today, defying the years that have since gone by. It was that vitality of spirit which forced your head to conceive and your hands to execute, which defied sleep as you now defy age. But it did not work alone on your mind and body. And that, I suspect, is the secret of your great success. It worked on and through your heart. And that, I know, is the secret of this meeting. Your head and your body, driven to their utmost, could not alone have stood the strain. It needed one thing more, and that you had. A vital sympathy with and generosity toward men, your own assistants and associates. This drew around you at Menlo Park a group of young men voluntarily worshiping at your shrine, now known as Edison Pioneers, but who might well be known as the apostles of the electrical industry. We welcome those pioneers who are here, and we send our greetings to them who are assembled in your honor at Menlo Park. Mr. Edison, as you grew older and projected that vitality in other fields, great leaders, men, women, and children everywhere have been attracted by it. All seek to do you honor. The President of the United States is here. Millions of people, not alone in your own country, but in others, celebrate with you tonight on the radio, and without your lamp as a forerunner, the radio would have been impossible. Most conspicuous of the many is our host, Mr. Henry Ford. He has built the Edison Institute of Technology and Industrial Museum in your honor. Other men could have built an institute, but Mr. Ford has done something more. When certain materials are exposed to radium, And no greater honor could be done to Mr. Edison and to this company than the presence of Madame Curie. When certain materials, as I said, are exposed to radium, the glow of that marvelous element continues for time and perhaps eternity. It lights up dark places like the radium-exposed hands on our watches. And so Mr. Ford has brought to Greenfield Village not only every piece of apparatus which Mr. Edison used at Menlo Park, but every chair, brick and stone, and even earth, in order that these common things, once exposed to the penetrating personality of Thomas A. Edison, may radiate from this museum for generations to come the vitality which is his. In the same group of buildings, and a part of the same village, is the courthouse touched with the personality of Lincoln. The cobbler shop in which Whittier mended shoes. The building in which Luther Burbank worked at Santa Rosa. And I'm sure that Mr. Ford will pardon me for mentioning the schoolhouse in which he himself sat as a boy. And last, and perhaps loveliest of all, there's the church which is built from the bricks of Mrs. Ford's father's house and carries the doors of that house, the opening and closing of which in the years gone by meant so much to Henry Ford. What a glorious community. It will light for the future, the darkness of the past. I cannot close what I have to say without congratulating Mr. Edson Ford, joint host with his father on this occasion, on receiving such an inheritance. Nor can I omit to congratulate Mr. Henry Ford on having such a worthy trustee to carry on. Ladies and gentlemen everywhere, I welcome you as participants in this celebration, made great because it is the affectionate tribute of one master workman to another, Mr. Henry Ford to Mr. Thomas A. Edison. Great pleasure for me now to introduce Mr. Barstow, who will speak for the Edison Pioneer.
Gathered around you on the occasion of your birth. Their fondest hopes have been realized. Tonight they have been given the privilege of joining the world in expressing their admiration and love. Although many of the Edison pioneers have passed away, those who remain well remember the long days and nights of uninterrupted labor, which finally produced results, as you say, far beyond your thoughts on the night of October the 21st, 1879. On the night when the first lamp glowed, history recorded one of the greatest achievements of men, the extent of which even now cannot be realized. Many an obstacle seemingly insurmountable, you overcame through your perseverance, courage, and optimism. Nor were you satisfied with the great achievements of the lamp, but turned your efforts into other fields where new discoveries and inventions resulted in further benefits to mankind. The value of your contribution to the welfare and comfort of your fellow men can never be measured. And based on them will be many new developments in years to come. In place of empires, you have founded industries which are engaged throughout the world in advancing human progress. The struggle of light against darkness has been won under a single leader. The Edison pioneers, in their many years of close association with you, have learned not only to admire your outstanding genius and ability to solve the most difficult problems, but to treasure as well your lifelong friendship. With a familiar twinkle in your eye, you many times enlivened the long hours with a joke.
Mr. Henry Ford will not speak. But as our host, I will ask him to rise. Majesty's Principal Secretary for Foreign Affairs conveys to Mr. Edison the following message on behalf of His Royal Highness, the Prince of Wales. The Prince of Wales is glad to learn of the celebrations that are taking place at Durban in connection with the 50th anniversary of the electric lamp, and His Royal Highness sends his congratulations and good wishes to Mr. Edison on this occasion. President, the President of Germany, on the day on which the American nation pays enthusiastic homage to its great son, I beg to extend to you, my dear Mr. Edison, on my own behalf and on behalf of the German people, the most sincere congratulations. Your name is in Germany, as in the whole civilized world, inseparably connected with numerous inventions which have given to our electric age its fundamental character. As one who shares with you the same age, I wish you many further years of fruitful activity for the benefit of humanity. Signed, President von Hindenburg. Message from Commander Byrd. For Thomas Edison anniversary dinner, one of the most distant places from you on the face of the earth, that is inhabited by man, is little America. And yet even here at the bottom of the world, there is rejoicing at this anniversary, for within the past few months we have had good reason to be grateful to you on more than one occasion. The incandescent light of the beacon named after you has guided men to safety who had lost their way in the blizzards of the long winter night, and so you have been a benefactor even to those at the very ends of the earth. I send affectionate wishes for your continued good health, and all the inhabitants of Little America join with my friend Henry Ford and his guests and the nation in sincerest expressions of gratitude and heart greetings, in which we wish to include that other radiant spirit who along with you has earned the everlasting gratitude of mankind, Madame Curie. Now, ladies and gentlemen, no words of mine can satisfy your hearts. Mr. Thomas A. Edison.
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, I am told that tonight my voice will reach out to the four corners of the world. It is an unusual opportunity for me to express my deep appreciation and thanks to you all for the countless evidences of your goodwill. I thank you from my bottom of my heart. I would be embarrassed at the honors they are being heaped upon me on this unforgettable night. Were it not for the fact that in honoring me, you are also honoring that vast army of thinkers and workers of the past, and those who have carried on, without whom my work would have gone for nothing. If I have spurred men to greater effort, enough for work, and if our work widened the horizon, of men's understanding even a little, and given a measure of happiness in this world, I'm content. This experience makes me realize, as never before, that Americans are as sentimental. And this crowning event of late golden jubilee fills me with gratitude. I thank our president and you all, Mr. Henry Ford. Words are inadequate to express my feelings. I can only say to you that in the fullest and richest meaning of his terms, he is my friend. Good night.
I might be pardoned for testifying to my admiration for his work and my great respect for him. Truly, I may say that if he were a private citizen, he would be entitled by reason of his accomplishments to take the prominent place which he now holds on this program. But he is not a private citizen. Ladies and gentlemen, President of the United States. This is a unique opportunity for the nation to pay to Mr. Edison that tribute and that honor which lies in every heart. An honor and a tribute not alone for the invention of the electric lamp, not only for the scores of other inventions with which he has endowed humanity, but because he has been a great American and he has lent distinction to every American citizen. The multiplication of the amount of light in the world is a thousandfold is worthy of celebration. For darkness is a forbidding limitation on righteous human activities. When Mr. Edison invented the electric lamp, he may perhaps thought just to produce plain light, more of it, at less cost. I surmise that his wildest ambition was to relieve the human race from the curse of always cleaning up lamps, scrubbing up candle drips, and everlastingly carrying one or the other of them about. But the electric lamp has found
a widely unexpected series of uses. It has enabled us to postpone the use of our spectacles for a few years longer. It has made reading in bed infinitely more comfortable. By merely pushing a button, we have introduced the element of surprise in dealing with burglars. The goblins that lived in the dark corners and under the bed have now been driven outdoors. Evil deeds which inhabited the dark have been driven back into the furthest retreats of the night. It enables the doctor to peer into the recesses of our insides. It substitutes for the hot water bottle in aches and pains. It enables our cities and our towns to clothe themselves in gaiety by night, no matter how sad their appearance is by day. And by all of its multiple uses, it has lengthened the hours of our active lives. It has decreased our fears. It has replaced dark with good cheer. It has increased our safety. It has decreased our toil and enabled us to read the type in the telephone book. It has become a friend of man and child. But as great as Mr. Edison's discovery of the electric lamp has been, or the many other great discoveries and inventions with which he has endowed the world, there is perhaps one less noticed, but maybe even greater. And that was the discovery of the method of invention. That method to be that highly equipped, definitely organized, laborious laboratory research alone transforms the raw material of scientific knowledge into new tools for the hand of man. In early times, mechanical invention had been the infrequent and the haphazard product of the genius of a woodchuck. But science had become too sophisticated a being to be wooed in such surroundings. Mr. Edison was the pioneer in the determination of the new method of applied science. And nowadays, 1,000 applied sciences laboratories have followed upon Menlo Park. Supported by the industries of their country, they yearly produce to us 1,000 of inventions. I can perhaps illustrate this modern method of invention. The fundamental natural laws of electricity were discovered 3/4 of a century ago by Faraday, by Hertz, and by Maxwell and other great investigators in the realms of pure physics and mathematics. Faraday discovered that energy could be transformed into electricity through induction, the theory of the electric generator. It was one of the most momentous discoveries of history. It was related that Gladstone was induced to visit Faraday's laboratory to see this new contraption. And when Gladstone said to have made the characteristic practical man's inquiry, "Will this ever be of use to mankind?" Faraday replied, "Someday you'll collect taxes from it." Mr. Edison, by organized, systematic laboratory search, was the man who converted Faraday's discovery into taxable property. Today, the governments of the world levy upon upwards of 60 billions of wealth founded upon electricity. But the taxes and the new wealth are not Mr. Edison's major accomplishment, nor the major accomplishment of men of his genius. They are the rivers of sweat saved from the backs of men and the infinite drudgery relieved from the hands of women. I would like to emphasize that both scientific discovery and its practical application are the products of long and arduous research. Mr. Edison's life has been one of constant toil. For discovery and invention do not spring full grown from the brains of men. The labor of a host of assistants of great laboratories and long, patient scientific experiment build up the structure of knowledge, not even stone by stone, but by particle by particle. This adding of fact to fact someday brings forth a revolutionary discovery, an illuminating hypothesis, a great generalization, or a practical invention such as the electric light. Mr. Edison has ever been the exponent of research in both pure science and its application in the arts as the most potent of impulses to progress in our nation. For in it is organized research that gives the daily improvement in machines and processes, its methods of agriculture, and in the protection of health and understanding. From these we gain constantly in better standards of living, more stability of employment, lessen toil and lengthen human life, and in the end our leisure expands and our interest in life enlarges and our vision stretches and there is more joy in life. It is the increasing productivity of men's labors through the tools given us by science that shattered the gloomy prophecies of Malthus. More than a century ago, that great student held that increasing population would outrun the food supply and starvation was the inevitable executioner of our overcrowded earth. But since his day, we have seen the paradox of the growth of population far beyond anything which he had ever dreamed, coupled at the same time with constantly increasing standards of living and ever-increasing surpluses of food. Malthus was right, except for a new contestant in the race with his principle. And that was more scientific research, more scientific discoveries, Thomas A. Edison and his colleagues in invention and science. And that race is still on. And in establishing this institute, Mr. Ford is doing honor to Mr. Edison in a manner which appeals to our sense of fitness. That is, by founding an institution dedicated to education and scientific research. It is indeed a generous act for a friend. It is a great service for the nation. And scientific research means more than its practical results in living comfort. The future of our nation is not merely a question of the development of our industries and of reducing the cost of living, or multiplying our harvests, or even of larger leisure. We must constantly strengthen the fiber of national life by the inculcation of that veracity of thought which springs alone from the search for the truth. From its pursuit, we shall discover the unfolding of beauty. We shall stimulate the aspiration for knowledge. We shall ever widen human understanding. Mr. Edison has given a long life to such service. Every American owes a debt to him. It is not alone a debt for the great benefactions that he has brought to mankind, but also a debt for the honor he has brought to our country. By his own genius and effort, he rose from modest beginnings to membership amongst the leaders of men. And his life gives inspiration and confidence to every youth in our land that the door of opportunity still stands open. And our civilization is much like a garden. It is to be apprised by the quality of its blooms. In degree as we fertilize its soil with liberty, as we maintain diligence in cultivation and guardianship against destructive forces, do we then produce these blossoms, the fragrance of whose lives stimulate renewed endeavor, give to us courage to renewed effort, and confidence for the future of our country. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are privileged tonight to be present not only at history in the remaking, but at history in the making. I hope every child in the country is close to a loudspeaker at this time. Great moments in history are not frequent, and it now seems eminently proper to me that the first international broadcast should convey the thanks of the world to the founder of this age of light, and that you and I and our children should be allowed to listen in. The next voice you will hear will be that of the distinguished scientist, Professor Albert Einstein, speaking from Berlin in Germany.
Ladies and gentlemen,
free supper.